Well, first off, if you want to get into mining, I really think you can be successful at it very small or very big. I think in the middle, you can really get messed up.
Hey, listeners, let's talk about revolutionizing your mining operation with Foreman. This isn't your average management tool. It's an all-in-one solution for reducing costs and significantly boosting your revenue. Foreman brings a cutting-edge dashboard to your fingertips, empowering you with automated energy strategies. This means not only curtailing around real-time prices, but also strategically enhancing your profit margins through demand response. It's about leveraging energy efficiency to its fullest potential. With Foreman, you get a system that scales with your business. Inventory management for assets, infrastructure integration, and business intelligence. Foreman elevates the cash flow and production of your entire operation. To see how Foreman can redefine your mining operation standards, visit foreman.mn. With Foreman, you're not just managing a mining operation, you're setting a new standard.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the Mining Pod. This is episode 4 of our immersion / takeover of the podcast. We're here with Mark Fresca and our guest, Russell Kahn, who is the head of mining at Core Scientific. So Russell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, cool. We're going to keep things simple. If you could give us a little background, who is Russell Kahn? Who are you? How did you come about to be head of mining at Core Scientific?
So I joined Core in 2017 when a company that I founded got rolled up into Core. I was doing Ethereum mining, GPU mining, and Core at the time it had a different name, but it was doing it was a small miner doing S9 Bitcoin mining, and starting in late 17. I went into operations and client services and revenue generation. And over the past couple of years, we've grown Core to have data centers in 5 states, 7 campuses in 5 states. At this point, we're doing mostly, almost completely Bitcoin mining. For a long time, we did a lot of Ethereum mining, we did a lot of GPU hosting as well. So we have a background there, but right now we're doing all ASICs and all Bitcoin mining.
You're cool.
So just kind of off of curiosity, what was your life like before Core? Like what was your background?
You know, for 20 years, I had a series of tech businesses that I'd started, mostly in networking and internet service providers, that kind of stuff. But I'd grown a couple businesses to span a footprint across the United States. Before that, I'd worked for a company called Anderson Consulting, eventually called Accenture. And I worked in fintech in both Europe and in Central and South America. So banking and banking systems, that kind of stuff. So I've been in tech for a while.
So what's your day-to-day like these days? Core's been around for a while. You've been there for a very long time, and I'm sure your position has changed a bit, but you know, you're a familiar face that everyone knows.
So, you know, for the most part, you know, we've spent the past year, for a while there, we actually were, I mean, we still are a very large miner, one of the largest miners in the world. Last year, our facilities produced 26,000 Bitcoin. This year, our facilities will produce about 24,000 Bitcoin. And that's across our machines and our clients' machines. But I say that to say this past year, my daily life has been spent a lot doing efficiency, working with the operations team, the software team, the facility engineering team, because we're trying to not necessarily be the largest miner in the U.S. or in any particular area, but we're trying to be a very efficient miner. And that has to do with, you know, software stack and also curtailment and power relationships. It has to do with the hardware. It has to do with keeping the hardware clean so we keep it running. It has to do with repairs and the velocity of repairs. It has to do with supply chain on parts and that kind of stuff. So day-to-day is mostly on efficiency and trying to be an efficient operator.
Yes, yeah, so you jumped right into the technology side. And before we go down that rabbit hole, there's one question we've been asking like all of our guests, right? So you gave us a little intro on who you are, obviously big tech background, sold a couple companies. What was the orange pill moment for you? Was there a specific day or specific time where somebody showed you Bitcoin or really clicked in your mind of this is where I want to go in my career? Because I mean, you're obviously very successful in networking some of these early technology companies. What made the shift for Bitcoin or maybe crypto? Because I know there was some Ethereum mentioned. You know, what was that moment for you?
Yeah, so I have to say I haven't swallowed the orange pill completely. Although I'm not a maximalist on Bitcoin, but I love the distributed processing, the distributed nature of the Bitcoin network. I think from a database system, the way it's distributed across the globe and its resiliency is amazing to me. I also find it amazing and interesting how the whole industry has become an efficient infrastructure and hardware provider for a very particular type of processing. And I say that because we'll talk about it later, but there's some other stuff in the world of AI that's going that same direction that's really interesting to watch. But I guess the financial aspects of Bitcoin have been fascinating to me in my banking background and in the world of economics. That's always fascinating to me. But it's really how the data is processed and managed globally that is really, you know, what I guess I said I wasn't an orange pill, but I guess I did kind of take an orange pill in that area. So
I mean, my next question is going to ask you what gets you excited from a technical aspect these days, but you pretty much just hit that nail on the head. How about where do you see innovation or a lack of innovation happening in this space? And you can bring that back into AI as well, if you'd like.
So, you know, the real innovations have, so silicone has pretty much, I'm not saying there's not innovation in silicone because there is, but for a while, the innovation in silicone was literally just the world of Bitcoin ASICs catching up with the rest of the world. So you had every 2 or 3 years, a new machine was coming out and all it was doing was going down the ASIC curve. And it seemed like there was monster innovation happening, but it really wasn't. The innovation was just, hey, we're just getting access to lines at TSMC for the next chip down in the stack. We've kind of hit that wall, though, in that the chips that we're now looking at are the chips that, you know, Apple's looking at and everyone else is looking at. So I think there's going to be some real innovation is going to be happening on the hardware side. And I don't mean right at this moment because, again, we're seeing the 5 and the 4 nanometer, or even seeing some 3 nanometer stuff that's going to be coming out next year. But after that, I think the generations of hardware is going to have to really, there's going to be some innovation and some maturity in the hardware area for us to see the same kind of hardware gains. So I think along with that, infrastructure is going to have some serious innovation in order to combine with new silicone to get the kind of results that we've been getting. So we have a built-in halving every 4 years. So your revenue is cut in half every 4 years. So you're naturally incentivized, if you're one of these operators, every 4 years, you have to double your efficiency. And that doubling of efficiency has to come from somewhere. The first 2 or 3 halvings, it literally just came from compute power, right? We moved from CPUs to GPUs to ASICs. And then we rapidly, for the first several halving events, even the two I've been involved with, it involved just improving your ASICs. You could really just buy the next generation of machines, say, okay, these have got to last me 2 years. They can literally run in the desert and be filled with dust when I'm done because I'm going to bury them because we're going to replace them with new machines that are too efficient for me to care about the old machines. Well, all that is past us now. We're okay for this halving coming up. And if you've just been an operator in the space and you have your containers in the middle of a field somewhere and you're running some generic software, you're going to be okay at this halving. Come April, May, your revenue is going to cut in half, but your whole world's not going to end by getting kicked in the head. The halving after that, your whole world's going to end by getting kicked in the head if you have not become an efficient operator. And by efficient there, I'm talking about marrying your silicone and what your hardware is going to look like with what your infrastructure looks like. And I'm not saying it has to be immersion, which you guys talk a lot about. It has to be really great air cooled, or it has to be water cooled, or it has to be chilled at the chip level. But you have to be thinking about it, and you have to be thinking, okay, where's my innovation going to come from? And our hardware manufacturers, you're already seeing that in that some of them are getting very sophisticated in the systems they have and in the systems they plan to bring out. So it's going to have to be, by the time the 28 halving happens, operators, those that are really operating facilities, are going to have to innovate, and they're going to have to be thoughtful about where they're spending their CapEx and thoughtful about where their engineers are spending their time.
And yeah, you kind of like fed into my next question on the silicone innovation, right? Like, where do you see, or what are you excited about? Like, obviously people are designing systems like WhatsMiner for the hydro and having them be rack mounted, right? Bitmain has their own hydro solution. There's a lot of us working on different immersion, you know, different products and things like that. From your personal viewpoint or Core's viewpoint, like, which one are you guys excited about? Are you guys testing all of them, looking at some of them? Where do you think the innovation will be in 5 years? Like, what do you think would win out from a market perspective versus hydro air immersion? What's your thought on that?
So, you know, as far as hydro versus air versus immersion, I really think it's going to be where people have experience and where their environment is. You know, but with a big but, machines and your infrastructure need to be married together. So I think in the past, when you've had immersion systems, and Taylor, you're well aware of this, you would take a machine that was built for air and you would convert it into an immersion system. I think in 5 years from now, and it's already happening, by the way, you're going to see systems that are built for immersion systems. And you're going to see systems that are specialty built for rack-mounted, water-cooled with, you know, water to the chip. And you're going to see systems that are specially built for air-cooled. You know, our Marble, North Carolina data center, it gets maybe to 40 degrees cold. Every once in a while, it snows there. And it gets maybe 72 degrees in the summertime. But when your actual temperature outside is what you set your HVAC to at your house every day for most of the year, it's a great environment for air cooled. So you don't necessarily get the benefits from immersion or hydro cooled or, you know, at the chip. However, if you're in, you know, we have a West Texas site where it's really damn hot. You know, immersion there might be a great example. You can also make air cooled work there. So I think whether air cooled, immersion, or, you know, rack mounted water cool wins out, it's not going to be a winner or a loser on necessarily systems, but I think people that have infrastructure built around the environments where their infrastructure are going to migrate towards very specific systems. Now, I do think systems are going to get more sophisticated. I think we're going to see a lot more opportunities to have rack mounted systems that fit a lot more into the traditional data center world. And the closer the BTC world can move towards that world, the more efficient we're going to get. The world has already gotten efficient on a lot of those data center systems, and we need to take advantage of that. Now, one thing where we are more efficient is the world of BTC has learned. BTC has very specific parameters around how it tries to process data, and we build data centers around that. We build systems around that. So I'm not saying we're going to go back to, you know, mining BTC in a traditional data center. That's because we're not ever going to do that. It makes no sense to do that. But I think we're going to take advantage of some of the systems that traditional data center world, the rack mount systems, the water cooled systems, the water at the chip systems, immersion, which has been around and is very sophisticated in that area. I think we're going to see data center operators that are mining BTC, you know, move into that area over the next 5 years because they're going to have to before the 2028 halving.
Yeah, I think there's a lot both DC operators and Bitcoin mining operators can learn from each other, right? I think from our side, like our PUE and the efficiency at the facility level is obviously much more efficient than a data center, right? But their levels of cleanliness, humidity control, all those types of things do provide a better environment. I've been talking a lot about internally, we really need some sort of like OCP working group inside of data center mining, just like they have over in the data center industry, right? That way we can all share ideas and have these more, you know, efficient builds and whatnot, which I do think is something that could be very valuable for the industry in the future. So definitely agree with you there. Mark, hand it over to you.
So Russell, one of the things that popped in my mind, because we're talking about, you know, like the standards that you find with normal data centers, are you familiar with the Bitfury, like the B8 and their rackable, you know, like the 6U, like, I take that as a yes.
I have PTSD from my back hurting.
Oh, they're so heavy.
Yeah. So, but hey, you know, the thing with that Bitfury B8, yes, now it was a monster of a machine, but, you know, it was the first rack mounted one, and it made a whole lot of sense for a whole lot of reasons other than the fact that it weighed like 600 pounds and took a scissor lift to move it off the ground. So, you know, I actually think, and by the way, MicroBT has got some nice rack mounted stuff coming out. I think we're going to see some rack mounted systems that take advantage of just the ease of using a rack mounted system. It makes a whole lot of sense, right? Like we had a bunch of spondulis at our Marble site and they were all rack mounted systems, man. I mean, and they ran like champs and they never actually broke or turned off. They literally just became uneconomical at some point. So we had to turn them off. Like those rack mounted systems can work really well. And by the way, it was in a passive air cooled environment. We literally had U-racks bolted in and they just exhausted right into a hot aisle, just like S9s and the main form factors do. So those kind of systems can work. And I think we will see them working. One of the things you guys asked me some innovation I think is going to happen. And I actually mentioned this on a panel a while back. I think one of the areas, and it's probably not by 28, but after 28. So we have this current halving where everything's going to kind of happen. We have the next halving where we just talked about systems and facilities integration. The next thing we're going to need to do before the halving after 28, so we go out 32, is we're going to have to figure out how to take all that waste heat that we're producing and we're going to have to put it back into the system. And that, so that waste heat is going to have to go into either through immersion, where we're then taking and putting it in some kind of generation where we're using the heat to generate power, or we're using that waste heat. Because one of the areas of innovation that I think can happen at the system level on a rack mount, and I say this because MicroBT has already started down this route, is taking that heat and doing something else with it. So eventually that's going to be an area of innovation that we can have as well. So sorry, I'm getting off on a tangent there.
No, so it's not a tangent. We actually, on one of our previous podcasts, I talked about how I had a client in some Scandinavian country where apparently there is a hot water line service, and they would heat the water and the government would pay them, and they put the hot water to buildings, and that's how they would heat the building. So I think it's pretty cool. And then touching on the server rack, I mean, it's another Bitfury thing, but I thought it was pretty cool there. The Bitfury box, whatever it was called back in the day, was a good old 6U server rackable Bitfury, but it had like water inlet hoses. So you plug it in, and now it's hydro-cooled. And I think that's the one thing all the manufacturers are missing now with their hydro containers, are it's still that shoebox design, and there's just so much wasted space versus there's just super high density with rackable equipment. This does bring me into my next question. Now, what are your thoughts on new manufacturers entering the space, like Auradine, Chain Reaction? A lot of companies have tried to enter the space and have failed because, I mean, you're going against two giant behemoths with MicroBT and Bitmain. What are your thoughts on that?
So you named four companies I have a lot of respect for there. Legacy guys, MicroBT, and Bitmain. Of course, you guys know we're a Bitmain shop. We have about 600,000 Bitmain machines that run through our facilities. But I'm also a big fan of Auradine and Chain Reaction, especially their engineering teams. So I think that one of the things in the past was where we were at on the silicon curve. And I think that created a problem, because if you were already in the space and you had your supply chain set up, the time it takes to engineer one of these ASIC systems versus the time you get to market, if you go back the previous halving, the halving before that, and at times when other manufacturers tried to get into the space, it was literally a supply chain issue. By the time they got the chip engineer and they got everything ready, and the time they got to market, they were already a year behind everybody else because the other folks had already moved on to the next chip. And no matter how good your engineering was, the fact that you were moving from a 28 nanometer chip to a 14 nanometer chip made up for any kind of really great engineering time you spent. So I think I say all that to say, as we move from a 5 to a 4 to a 3 nanometer chip, it does create opportunities for other firms to come into the space, those that have deep silicon experience. It gives them an opportunity to come in, because there's just not, the innovation is going to happen at the engineering level. We have a 5 nanometer, 21 joule machine that comes out from Bitmain, the XP. Well, the next 4 nanometer is great at 16 joules. But guys, that's only 5 joules. I mean, it sounds like a lot, and on a percentage basis, it still is, but it's not a 200, 300, or 400% gain like we've been having. And in the world of a Bitcoin run, like when it's really running, right? Like, and we've seen this happen before, 5 joules worth of operating cost will make no difference at all to anybody. Now, in the world where Bitcoin is at 15,000 and your operating cost is 16,000, every joule counts. And I'm here sitting here as a company as a prime example. Every joule counts, but we know that in a run, it doesn't matter as much that those things. And I say that to say, as we move down that curve and we move down from the 5 to the 4 to the 3 to whatever's going to come after the 3, the engineering and the good engineering teams will have an opportunity to come to market with something. So I do think there's going to be some room in this next cycle for some of these new entrants. I think your Bitmains of the world have hundreds of engineers that have been working on this for years and are really good. I think your MicroBTs of the world that have all this supply chain and systems experience that they have, I think they're going to have an advantage. But I think your Auradines and your Chain Reactions of the world will be able to come to the table with some quality engineering, and we'll pick up some market share.
Do you think these Chinese manufacturers having such a large market share is a problem for our ecosystem? Some people pitch that, we need to become less dependent on these manufacturers. What are your thoughts?
That's a loaded question, because you're talking to someone again who has, 220,000 Chinese manufacturers. Well, they're Taiwanese chips, and in our case, they're manufactured in Malaysia, Indonesia, or Thailand. In the case of MicroBT, they're also manufactured in Thailand. So I do think that it is better for the whole ecosystem if there is some competition and it's spread out globally. But I also think it's the same thing for concentration of hash rate. You know, when we had total concentration, most of the mining was going on in China. That was not good for the ecosystem. That very next fall, when you looked and all the concentration was in North America, that's also not good for the system. I think for, you know, by the way, it's good for me personally. I work at a company and we want, you know, monster hash rate in the United States. But for the Bitcoin network and for Bitcoin adoption, the whole reason why Bitcoin has such a drive and such a global presence and such a global adoption is because it can literally work anywhere. And it can work anywhere where we have systems. So I think it's good to have U.S. or Canadian manufacturers or to have Israeli manufacturers along with your Chinese manufacturers and Korean manufacturers. Quite frankly, MicroBT, all those units come out of Samsung, you know, the chips come out of Samsung. So I think that kind of diversity is good. Is the concentration risk there? It probably is if the Chinese government wanted to lean in hard. The fact that the silicone is all made outside of China does kind of diversify some of that risk away, I think.
So, Russell, you said, you know, earlier it was a really good point. They finally have an entry point into the market. There's finally coming to a time where they have enough time to engineer the chip, engineer the box. You know, you spoke a little bit about efficiency not being the most important thing in the world. What kind of features could these new providers or, you know, what kind of additions could they make to what we've seen in our normal mining machines that would make a company like Core Scientific or CleanSpark, you know, jump at an opportunity to go take the risk and buy a new machine? Is it run at higher temperatures? Is it more control of the firmware? Is it a different way of delivering power? Talk to us about like what you think is really important when you're doing machine selection.
You're naming them. So, you know, the simple fact that if you're air cooled, there's plenty of air cooled options, but if you're wanting to go immersion, there's some systems where you will be able to say, hey, I want to do immersion, or I want to do two phase immersion, or I want to do water cooled. So I do think that the customization, and I don't necessarily mean they're making bespoke systems for one individual miner, but the customization that can happen on the front end when someone's, because if you're a new entrant coming to space and you say, I want to sell 20,000 units and to be successful this year. Well, 20,000 units could be spread out over a lot of smaller operators, or you could pick one operator and say, I will build a system that fits your immersion, or I'll build a system that fits your air cooled. I'll build a rack mount system for you. So that kind of thing does exist. So I think some of those customizable systems are going to be strong. I do think software is going to be important. And I think some of the control as far as ramping up hash rate and ramping down joules per terahash are going to be important. You know, as we, again, it wasn't as important in previous halvings, but as we go forward, if there's a Bitcoin run, people are going to want to say, you know what? Forget about joules per terahash. Crank that baby up. I don't want to be a 100 terahash machine. Give me a 200 terahash machine, even if it's at 40 joules. So I think people will appreciate some of that flexibility, and also think people will appreciate some of the flexibility on temperature, operation temperature. Remember the S9, if we go back, and MicroBT has really been pretty good on their temperatures anyway, but previous two generations ago, those machines could operate at very, very high temperatures. But then this last generation, especially the Bitmain machines, got down to be very finicky outside of a very, very small band of temperatures. And people try to engineer around that. Now, I think our friends at Bitmain have solved that for the S21. They're going to have a much higher temperature range. But I think that's an area where operators particularly appreciate having machines that can operate at high temperatures. If you're in a situation of Core, for instance, or CleanSpark in Georgia gets hot too, where you have a hot summer, that makes a real difference to your hash rate in the summertime and in the heat of the day. So I think some of those things are going to give new entrants an opportunity to come to market with things that make certain operators peek their head up and say, you know what, I'll take the risk there.
And do you think there's any value of a machine that isn't made at TSMC or Samsung? You know, especially us being US operators, we see what's going on in the political spaces and things like that. Are you ever concerned about the foundries being, let's call it, you know, so few and far between that actually produce the most cutting edge chips?
So as a U.S. operator, I probably would not this is again, it's just a U.S. operator. I would not operate machines that where the chips come from somewhere other than TSMC or Samsung right now. Now, if there's certainly with the CHIPS Act, there's going to be more foundries here in the United States. And I think that's going to be very attractive and compelling to some people. So I think if I were an operator and I operated in Southeast Asia or operated in Africa or operated in Serbia or in Russia or something, I probably would not be as beholden to say, hey, I want a TSMC chip, or I want a Foundry, or I want a Samsung chip. But if I'm in the United States or I'm in North America, then I'm going to go where the manufacturer is going to have the chips come from those foundries.
Hey, another thing we wanted to touch on is we're seeing more and more of these new generation machines are coming with three-phase power supplies. You know, we went from single to 240, and now we're at three-phase. As we know, doing so involves changing your build out if it's an existing build out. And some of these miners with the 221 are exclusively with three-phase power supplies. What are your thoughts of this? Because not only is it now even higher power in that small footprint, but, you know, just the OPEX of, the CAPEX of just changing out a farm. Do you think this is something, you know, it's worth upgrading a farm to, or it's mainly for newer build outs, or just what are your thoughts on just this push to three phase?
Yeah. So I think much like if I was building a new facility right now, you have to ask yourself, is it going to be air cooled? Is it going to be water cooled? Or is it going to be immersion? Certainly if you're building new facilities, it's a no-brainer. If you have existing facilities, it's just math. You're going to have to do the math to say, okay. And at Core, we're having these conversations right now because, as you know, we have 7 campuses in 5 states. Well, our first 3 states of operation, North Carolina, Georgia, and Kentucky, we built prior to the previous halving. Prior to the previous halving, right? So, you know, those are things where we have the S21s coming in. We're saying, okay, you know, there's a facility there where you're gonna have to make some PDU changes. Now, of course, there's some other things you can do as well. But I think if you're going to build new construction, it's a no-brainer. If you're looking at machine life and existing facilities, you're just gonna have to run the math and see what works best for you. Three-phase has some other unique benefits, especially if you're operating, say, in Texas, where you have a grid where you're curtailing and stuff. Three-phase gives you some other opportunities, but I think it's going to be individual operators just to kind of do the math. But you're right. These new machines, new PSUs are going to require new PDUs in a lot of instances, or some reengineering to make it all work.
Do you think it's going to cause big issues with getting rid of that heat now that the footprint is the same size, but the power draw is going way up? I mean, it's legacy air-cooled sites might not be able to handle it.
Mark, you hit the nail. At Core, we have about, I think 35 or 40% of our staff is engineers, and a big chunk of them are software engineers, but there's also electrical engineers and our thermodynamic engineers. And when you're looking at this kind of stuff and you're saying three-phase, you absolutely hit something. And most time it's not until you're operating bigger sites that it hits you that, you know, you're still producing all that heat. And it's got to go somewhere. So if your airflow can't do it, you might have to augment. A lot of people have been able to use the passive air and been able to use just the fans from the machines themselves for a while, but they might find they have to augment that with some forced air, which would increase their the PUE. Most of us have been operating in the very, very low PUE range, but you might end up getting still single digit, but still you might have to have PUE you're not expecting, especially in the summer months. When you have to move that extra airflow. So that has to be accounted for in your CapEx as well. So if you're now either that, or you're also going to have the issue of maybe stranded power where you say, you know what, I just can't use all the rack space in that particular building because I'm producing too much heat there. And there again, especially if you're in a legacy site, it comes down to doing the math. It's like, okay, am I going to abandon a few rack spaces per shelf in order to move the air, which means I'm eventually going to have to build some more rack space somewhere else. So it's just math. It's math you'll have to do. And sometimes that math is going to be contingent upon what Bitcoin's doing, right? And I hate to say it that way, but if Bitcoin's moderate or low, you're making one decision. If Bitcoin's running hard, you're saying plug every damn thing in you can and add extra air cool because it's going to pay for itself in a few weeks. If Bitcoin is tight and your production costs and the revenue you have coming in is tight, you might just say, you know what, I'm not going to buy as many machines. I'm going to have less machines plugged in.
You know, you mentioned your staff there, 30, 40 staff engineers, a lot of them software guys. You know, you guys have a pretty impressive software stack, you know, the Minder operating system along with firmware. Can you tell our viewers just a little bit about that software, that stack, and maybe why you guys built it at Core and what value it brings to your guys' company rather than maybe using a Foreman or, you know, an aftermarket firmware solution?
Yeah, so at Core, we're close to have plugged in over 800,000 machines. Been running 800,000 machines. I think we're slightly under 800,000 right now from 16 different manufacturers. And we've done that in environments where we have, like our Marble, North Carolina site, where the weather's perfect all the time, in West Texas, where it's really like the heat of the desert all the time, and in North Dakota, where it's negative 60 degrees Fahrenheit at the coldest day of the year. So we've done that in environments where, and infrastructure where it's just so different that what we decided on the software side is our software team worked for years, has always worked closely with our operations team. And we've always said that our data center technician was our client for our software team. And we try to say, what can we do to make our data center technician's life easier? And our software management system was built around that. Now, of course, we've always said, I just told you, we've spent the past year saying we need to be an efficient miner. And that goes into, can we get more joules per terahash out of this thing? Or can we get more terahash out of a machine if Bitcoin runs? So we do operate on those areas as well. But for the most part, a lot of our software is around operating our facilities efficiently, trying to make our data center technicians' lives easier, trying to make repairs easier. And then because we are in Texas, we also integrate with the power grid and trying to make sure that we can curtail. Because, you know, this past winter, last year in wintertime, you know, we had a major winter storm across the whole United States. We actually curtailed for days at a time for every site except for North Dakota. And now that was unusual that every site curtails. But in Texas, when it's hot in the summertime, you know, there could be curtailments that happen that just last 1 hour or last 15 minutes, just depending on when the Texas power grid needs the power. And, you know, that's a pretty sophisticated software stack to power down a 300 megawatt site. And then, oddly enough, what's even more difficult is powering it back up at the right time, because when you have these grids, there's harmonics and grid stability that are very important. And you can't just turn off 300 megawatts, nor can you just turn it back on again, because you actually destabilize the grid if you turn on 300 megawatts all of a sudden. So, and we have some pretty sophisticated software stacks to manage some of those large operations.
When a new miner comes out, let's call it the XP, how long does it normally take a Core Scientific team to build firmware and have everything ready for what I'd call like a commercial deployment, just everyday use?
So we actually, so if there's a brand new model where we've never seen anything, we try to get it a sample ahead of time, so that if either us as a miner, or in the past when we were at one point all hosting, and we were all hosting, what we tried to do was if we thought we had a machine coming from a client, we would try to get it integrated to our systems. At this point, it doesn't take too long for a new machine to get integrated in, just because we've got a lot of different experience. And quite frankly, until there's some real innovation on the mining side, a lot of these things look a whole lot alike. The control boards look a whole lot, you know, like the one before it or the one after, you know, immediately after it. So it doesn't take a very long time right now. Now, if you're talking about, you know, going in and doing frequency and voltage tuning on every single chip and making sure it's the most efficient, that takes a while because you can really burn a machine up, mess a machine up. And at Core, you know, you don't want to roll something like that over 200,000 machines, because if so, you've burned up $1 billion worth of stuff really fast, you know, so you take your time on it. But just integrating into our software stack and integrating into our curtailment stack and that kind of stuff, that piece is normally pretty quick. But like I said, there's a big chunk of our staff that are engineers, you know, a lot smarter than I am. So
you made a good point. The time it takes to get stable firmware, it's tricky because one mistake is really expensive, which kind of ties into a question I have. What's your favorite ASIC right now and why? And also, what's your most hated? And I can probably guess on which one that one is, but bigger I ask.
My personal favorite right now is the original S19 Pro, because I think that little thing is the closest to the original S9 that Bitmain's put out. And we're mostly a Bitmain shop. And although we have a lot of experience, we've had tens of thousands of Canon units, and we've had tens of thousands of MicroBT units, and we've had just about everything else in between too. Right now, we're mostly a Bitmain shop, so I'm talking Bitmain. And then if you ask me what we don't like right now, it's probably anything with Chromebacks is a pain in the ass to repair. Only because they're a pain in the ass to repair. You know, at Core, we repair tens of thousands of hash boards a month to kind of keep everything up. And the Chromebacks are just, they're difficult for our repair guys. So I'm going to say, I have to be very careful when you ask me questions about what machines I hate.
I was thinking you're going to say like the S17,
Oh, well, that's the easy one, of course. Oh, we're talking about that. Okay, then yes. We'll throw this F-17 in there. Even more than that, we'll throw the terrible T-17s in there too as well.
Oh, and the pluses. The pluses too.
Yeah, really. The S-17 Pro is a pretty good machine, and I would actually take one of those, because the chips are pretty good. They're still the 7-nanometer that we see right now. I thought you were talking about, like, current generation of stuff we're running. But, yes, the 17 series with their thermal paste issues, I think the whole world had issue with that model. And it was funny, though. It was really – so, in core, we were big enough that we had machines come off different manufacturing lines. So you would have some batches that had almost zero issues, and you would have some batches where literally as they come off the line or as they come in, all we do was just kind of shake it. Went, okay, we'll set that one over there. Shake it. Ooh, that one works. But I will say that, we have not had the issues we had with Bitmain for the 17 series. We really didn't have any of those issues with the 19 series at all. The DOEs for the 19 series we had with Bitmain were very, very low, if any. And if we did have any issues, they corrected them very quickly for us. So,
you know, before we get off the facilities topic, we're talking about integration with ASICs, and Russell, I've heard multiple times integrating the facility with the machine as being like a big point for you guys, right? I thought it was very cool that Core Scientific had a big tour of your guys' den facility, invited a lot of people from across the industry. So I'm hopeful that you can talk about this. You know, you showed us some temperature sensors and some things that are integrated to the building that your team uses. Could you talk to us a little bit about that, like, kind of next level development of the facilities, where we are kind of blending the line of data center versus Bitcoin mine, where you guys are utilizing some unique technologies to make your facilities function a little bit better?
Yeah, I would say, and you hit one of them that we do. So we've always had weather systems at all of our data centers, and then that's integrated into our software. And then we put custom made temperature sensors everywhere in our data centers. And I think we talked about that during our tour at Denton. And we use that actually to help us as far as our efficiency on our machines, but also during curtailments, because one of the things, previous generations of machines, if you knew your machine only needed to last for 3 years, you would just run the hell out of it sometimes at very high temperatures, because you're like, look, I've only got a few more months to get a return out of this machine. Well, one of the things at Core that we're really looking at with the 7-nanometer, the 5-nanometer, the 4-nanometer is what we're calling infinite life almost. So we actually, if it gets too hot and we think the input air is going to be too hot, we will downclock a machine. And we do that with our software using the temperature gauges we have throughout the facilities. And it also helps us with our engineering, because I think we talked about this on our tour when we did Denton. We've actually evolved, and the facilities at Denton are our fifth generation cathedrals. So we've gone from, brownfield to containers to cathedrals. Now we're on our fifth generation cathedral. And we actually can change our cathedral design on where machines go on the rack based on temperature feedback and machine feedback. So we have the temperature feedback from the machines themselves, but the temperature feedback from the temperature sensors we put there at facilities tell us if we're going to be downclocking or overclocking or have an opportunity to overclock. Or during curtailments, we might say, you know what, especially let's take wintertime in North Dakota. You can't turn on a machine when it's freezing. It will crack a machine. Now, there's new machines that are coming to market that might not have that experience, but you have to preheat areas. So we actually can sit there and say, okay, you know what, we've preheated this area. We're now going to close the dampers or close the airflow so that the back heat goes back into the next aisle over. And we'll know based on the temperature gauges throughout the building, like when we can turn and ramp machines up. So I'd say the weather sensors, the temperature sensors, those are two things that I think inside our facilities have really improved. They integrate to our software. They've really improved our efficiency. So
that's cool. No, I mean, we've covered a lot on the facility topic, a lot over the ASICs and different software that's used. Kind of pivoting, you know, you have some very unique experience. You've operated all over the world with some of your businesses, certainly all over the United States. How have you seen regulatory policies changing around Bitcoin? Do you think it's going in a positive direction where we're starting to lean into Bitcoin being a good thing? You see some articles saying good for energy grids, all this stuff. We have hit pieces that come out saying, you know, a whole pool of water per transaction. You know, how are you feeling about the current regulatory market, and, you know, where do you think we're going here in the United States if we want to just stay centralized to this country?
Okay, so just centralized to this country is interesting, because power grids in countries outside the United States, I think, are seeing the benefit of Bitcoin mining, are getting the benefit of Bitcoin mining much quicker than the U.S. grid. With that said, there's now been, because so Core opened up, we bought Marble in 17, in early January of 18, we mined the first Bitcoin at Marble. And Marble was the first really large scale, you know, U.S. Mine. It's 103 megawatts. And it was 103 megawatts, you know, for 5 years now, 6 years now. Anyways, those power companies that have had experience now, that have had 3, 4, and 5 years, I think they're starting to understand the benefit of the grid. I think your ERCOTs in Texas are starting to understand the benefits of the grid, but I still think there's an education for the general public and especially policymakers. So I think your engineers that need to run the grid are starting to see the benefit of being able to say, hey, I need to curtail that 300 megawatts over there in 4.5 seconds and pressing a button, not even pressing a button. The algorithm says do it and it just does it. So I think the engineers that need to run the grid see that benefit, but I think we still have some education that has to happen for that to make it to policymakers and to the general public. So like the instance with the pool and how much water it takes, I read that article, this is ridiculous. And then it went on to talk about, well, that's how much water it takes to actually produce power in general. It's like, well, that doesn't make any sense. You know, so I think there's some education that has to happen, and the education needs to be at the public level of why do we need Bitcoin mining on our power grid? And then at the policy level, it really needs to educate legislators and policymakers, but it almost doesn't need to come from us. It needs to come from power companies, and it needs to come from the engineering firms that have to, or the engineers that have to manage the power grid, because when we say it, it sounds like it's self-serving. But if a grid operator says, no, I really like having 500 megawatts of a fully curtailable load, it makes us not have to have any kind of peaker plants running. When they say it, it has a different meaning. Again, it's just a matter of, it's a matter of education.
And I think I know the answer to this, but where do you see from your guys' sides, who has the most buy-in, like state by state, who's working with you guys the most, who's the most excited about using, let's call it the battery aspect of Bitcoin, being able to turn on and off quickly? Where do you see being most developed or maybe the most innovation happening that we don't, you know, as outsiders get to see?
So, you know, interesting enough, at Core, we're running 700 or 800 megawatts right now, and about half of it, or about, I guess, no, maybe a third of it is in a deregulated market, Texas. The other two thirds of it's in a regulated market. So one of the interesting things is the fact that you would think the deregulated market would get it faster, but there's actually some regulated markets that really pick up on the benefits of the curtailment. So sometimes it's a regulated market and it's a smaller grid operator that can get things faster. So I would say if you look out into the future, I couldn't tell you if it's going to be a deregulated market like Texas or a regulated market like we have in Georgia or the Carolinas or Kentucky. I can't tell you which one of those is going to have the most growth, but I will tell you, I think that even in the regulated market, there's going to be some regulated rates created in the United States that are made for Bitcoin mining that have, you know, big pieces or curtailment options. Because in the regulated world, what we've done in the past is we kind of fit a square peg in a round hole by going in and looking at rates they had and said, okay, we're closest to that rate. But I think as we become more integrated into the grid and the whole power grid as a whole learns the benefits of turning on and having a big curtailable load, I think we're going to see the regulated markets actually start competing with some of the deregulated markets by saying, you know what, here's our Bitcoin load. Here's our Bitcoin rate card, guys. You got to be able to curtail 800 hours a year if we ask you. We might not ask you, but you got to be able to do it. But in exchange for that, the other 7,800, other, you know, 8,000 hours or whatever, the other 7,800 hours, you're going to have this really great rate with us. So I think we're going to see that in the future. So far, a lot of growth happened in the deregulated market, but like Texas, but I think that's mostly been just because Texas has, at least in West Texas, a large amount of excess capacity from their wind and solar generation they've been producing for years now. So
to pivot a little bit, we kind of want to ask you, like, what does the future at Core look like? I know we talked a little bit before the podcast about large language models, or learning models. LLMs. And I wanted to ask, what are your thoughts? Clearly you have some interest. Is that something?
Well, you know, I would tell you what's interesting. If you look at large language models, simulation AI and generative AI, they're all different processing types. And one of the interesting things about Ethereum, one of the interesting things about Bitcoin, one interesting thing about cryptocurrency in general is the distributed nature of the processing power. And I think if you look, and by the way, And the whole world, as miners, we all developed infrastructure that really worked for those things, right? So Ethereum miners got really good at running GPUs. They got really good at taking, you know, when I first got Ethereum mining, we had these open air Ethereum mines that I didn't realize we were just making little fireplaces, open air fire pits, basically what we were making. So we didn't learn, you know, you had to make a few of those and go, holy crap, we just heated up this entire building with these four miners, until you said, hey, we got to control that airflow. So once we learned to control that airflow and said, all right, this is starting to look a lot like Bitcoin mining. Well, again, we took and we created for infrastructure to match the silicon, to match the processing. And I think in the world of AI, we're going to see some of that happening. And I say that because, you know, large language models, they don't need the same kind of processing power that, say, a cloud, like a cloud service does. You have some interesting pieces there because the models are frozen. Like, you could freeze a model and store it every 10 minutes if you wanted to. Or in the world of generative AI, though, you know, if you stop in the middle, you can really screw some things up. So if you understand exactly, and simulation AI is also one of those things where you could screw it up. But if you understand like where you could stop processing and where you can interrupt it and where you could do it, where you could start it again, it really opens the door for saying, hey, is there a more efficient way for us to do some of this processing? So we know that with AI and large language models, we're going to see the world needs a lot of it. And by the way, what I mean by a lot of it, I mean it needs a lot of processing power and it needs a lot of actual power itself, like electricity. And that is because for every large language model, you have to create your own set of data. You know, you can't sit there and say, hey, I'm going to use ChatGPT-4 in order to run my call center for AT&T. Well, AT&T cell phones have some very specific data they want to run in their large language model to create their little version of a call center. So all those opportunities, all those need large language models where they throw data sets at them. So there's a big demand, and that demand is going to probably keep going for a while because the larger language models just need more and more processing. The larger simulations need more and more processing. And by simulations, guys, a good example is in the medical world. Like, you can take and use simulations for mRNA vaccines. And basically right now, one of the things is you have these health studies, these labs all over the world working on stuff. And it takes a long time for a human. Matter of fact, a human almost can't integrate all the great works that these scientists and biochemists are doing around the world. But an AI probably could. Like, you could take a simulation AI that can take in the lab data from all these labs all over the world and start saying, well, if we change the model and did this, this is the medical outcome that we would get from it. So I might be talking around in circles here, but I'm trying to use the USA Today version, not the Economist version, so that people would understand it. But the point is, there's going to be a big need for operational processing power in the world of AI because of the good things it can do. And much like what happened with Bitcoin mining, where infrastructure and silicon really went away to make it more efficient, I think we're going to see the same thing happen in AI. Now, I'm not saying that Bitcoin miners around the globe are going to become AI miners. That's just not going to happen. But I am going to say that infrastructure for large language models or for generative AI or for simulation AI, I think there's a big enough demand for those services to develop customized infrastructure and customized silicon to do those things in a more cost-efficient manner.
Yeah, what I think the point you're trying to get there is like the typical data center has like 7/9 reliability, needs to be on all the time, right? A lot of these models can be ran for, you know, 30 minutes cut off. And I guess you could even get into the idea, if you had multiple data centers with enough connectivity, you could be parsing out this data to the cheapest power, all sorts of things like that, right? Where you can really design these data centers to be spec'd for these types of computers. It actually goes along with the theme of this conversation, the blending of the BTC mine in the typical data center, like a tier three facility, finding that middle ground where there's profitability, but also you're getting like a really good compute surface, right? Which I think is super cool. You know, we are getting to the end of this. And one of the questions that we love to ask, and part of the reasons why we picked our particular guests is people that have a lot of experience and carry what I call like a big stick in the industry, right? What kind of personal or professional lessons have you learned going through this battle of becoming one of the largest Bitcoin miners that you'd like to share with people that are just entering the industry or, you know, maybe aspire to be a head of mining at a publicly traded company in the future?
Oh, well, first off, if you want to get into mining, I really think you can be successful at it very small or very big. I think in the middle, you can really get messed up. And what I mean by that is, you know, you could find it. I mean, I'm not saying you can find a few friends and do Bitcoin mining in your garage. That doesn't work anymore. But you also don't need to be a Core Scientific with 800 megawatts. You could be very successful in Bitcoin mining with a couple megawatts, and you can find that in lots of places, right? So I guess, gosh, what would I say I learned? learn from your mistakes. Iterate quickly. And when you make a mistake, don't let it beat you over the head, but, you know, quickly figure it out. You know, you can learn from those things. And I would say test a lot of things. Test everything, really. If you're going to be a Bitcoin miner or any kind of miner for that matter, before you say, hey, I want to go buy 10,000 of these widgets, make sure you test a couple of those widgets and make sure they do exactly what you want them to do. I would also say, oddly enough, at least in the world of Bitcoin mining, most people are very open to discussion things with you, and you can ask questions. So if you're thinking you're going to get into this game, go to some of the conferences and sit and watch panels and then just go talk to the people. Most people in this game and in this business, they've had huge successes, big failures, and they've learned from them, and they're willing to talk to you about it. You know, I've made some wonderful friends, and I call them up and ask them questions all the time. Hey, how did you solve this problem? And people are very open to say, well, here's how we solve that problem. It's like we toured the dent facility, and it's like, guys, come see what we did. Like, and, you know, if it can help you do something better, you know, for Bitcoin in general, is such a huge network, figuratively and literally, it's a big network, but there's so many people globally, and it's one of the few businesses I've ever been in where, you can have friends, and I can be on Telegram with friends in China or friends in Southeast Asia or friends in Australia or friends in Africa or friends in Europe. And it's an amazing thing. And all those folks though are just as friendly in person as they are on Telegram or WeChat or WhatsApp telling you and answering questions for you. So, don't be afraid to talk to people and ask them questions.
I mean, I think that story rings through. I think we all met at conferences, you know, throughout the years and gotten to know each other and exchanged ideas and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's really great advice for people to look into the industry. And I guess closing out, you know, Russ, we'll give you a couple minutes. What's the future of Core look like? What are you guys excited about? And, you know, what can you get the audience here excited about Core as you guys move into the new year?
So, you know, we have we're running, like I said, 700, 800 megawatts of facilities right now. Our next 200 or 300 megawatts are pretty much, you know, in sticks already. I think though at Core, you know, we try to take and turn electricity into high value compute. And I think you're going to see us, you know, branch out in that area. We've been in Ethereum mining before. We've been in GPU mining before. We've run AI centers. We've run NVIDIA DGXs before. So I think at Core, we're going to try to become as efficient as we can in the Bitcoin world. And then we're going to see where else, we can transform energy into high value compute. And I think we're going to try to do that in the most cost effective manner possible.
Well, I think we're all rooting for you guys to come out of BK. So we look forward to seeing those announcements throughout December and into January. But, yeah, we just want to say, Russell, thanks a lot for coming on. It's always good to have somebody of your caliber on the show. And we had a really good time filming this one.
All right. I appreciate it, guys. Thanks so much.